This is William Fife reporting from the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention at Cobo Hall. Massachusetts Senator John Kennedy has just arrived here at Cobo Hall for his address before the 61st Annual Convention. National Commander Louis Feldman has announced that Mr. Kennedy has arrived in the hall. Thousands of delegates are standing now to get a glimpse of the senator as he comes in from the back of the hall and starts heading toward the speaker's platform. You can hear the noise here in the background. The delegates are clapping hands, and the cowboy band from Hardin-Simmons College in Abilene, Texas, is whooping it up. You hear the noise. Senator Kennedy is coming into the hall now. There is no great demonstration. We can just make out his party entering the back door now, and here comes the cheer. Listen. Senator Kennedy arrived here in Detroit last night, actually early this morning at 12:30 at City Airport. He flew in his own plane. He was met at the airport by Governor G. Menin Williams and Lieutenant Governor John Swainson, the VFW National Commander Louis Feldman, plus scores of other VFW delegates. Here comes Senator Kennedy down the main aisle now. He's being escorted to the speaker's platform where he'll deliver a major address today. After the senator's speech today, he'll go directly back to Detroit City Airport. From there, board his plane and fly to Washington. A virtual stream of white-helmeted VFW members are leading Senator Kennedy down the main aisle now. All the delegates are standing on their chairs to applaud and to catch a glimpse. Unofficial reports indicate that the crowd here today is slightly smaller than the crowd that turned out for the speech of Vice President Richard Nixon. Mr. Kennedy is now nearing the speaker's platform. Governor Williams is with him. Lieutenant Governor John Swainson is there, and other party leaders from the state of Michigan. A number of Michigan's Democrats are off in Grand Rapids for the opening of their state convention, which opens in Grand Rapids tonight. And now Mr. Kennedy is being greeted by National Commander Louis Feldman. They are at the platform. Now, all the crowd can see Mr. Kennedy as he comes on the platform. He's wearing his VFW hat. He shakes hands with the chaplain, with Commander Feldman, and nears the speaker's platform. There was a wave to the crowd that was greeted by a cheer. We're standing right in front of the Massachusetts delegation, and no doubt we're picking up lots of their noise. A battery of press photographers and television cameras are right down in front of the speaker's platform now, snapping pictures, and there's the usual yell for one more. Massachusetts is yelling down in front, as are many of the other delegates. The picture taking now and the greeting is just about over. In a moment, we'll have the speech by Senator John Kennedy of Massachusetts. The Democratic nominee released a text of his speech early this morning. That speech will be delivered in a matter of minutes. The honor guard is now returning to the rear of Cobo Hall, of this gigantic arena. The governor and Lieutenant Governor John Swainson are taking their seats on the platform. Naturally, they're wearing their VFW caps too. And now, VFW National Commander Louis Feldman is about to make the introduction of Senator John Kennedy. Apparently, Mr. Feldman is waiting for the crowd to settle down just a bit more.
I will go out with him to the door, same as I did before.
The introduction of Senator Kennedy is being delayed by, as we told you earlier, a battery of press photographers and quite a group of VFW members who are here with their own cameras trying to snap the picture of Senator John Kennedy. National Commander Feldman has been to the speaker's stand at least four times now to start his introduction. Each time he's been delayed. Now he has stepped away from the microphones to have his picture taken with Mr. Kennedy, Michigan's Governor G. Menon Williams, and Lieutenant Governor John Swainson. The introduction has been an on-again, off-again sort of affair. Apparently, it will go in just a moment. The photographers have...
Now, my comrades, ladies and gentlemen,
Commander Feldman.
We're very happy to welcome the public of the Detroit Wayne County area here today, as we did earlier in the week. The veterans of foreign wars are of the belief that one of the greatest things we can do for this country is to awaken the people to the urgency and the necessity of taking a keen interest in politics and voting this November. In fact, I thought this would be an appropriate time to repeat a statement that I heard the former Democratic chairman make at a meeting that we attended at the American Heritage Foundation. And I think this pretty well expresses the feeling of many people. He said that he would much rather see a person vote Republican than not vote at all. Now, coming from a Democratic chairman, that expresses the urgency for this. That's a statement of Paul Butler, made at the American Heritage Foundation, and Thurston Morton, the Republican chairman, made a similar statement. So we urge you all to vote, and that is the reason we have opened the gates here this morning to the public of Detroit. The veterans of foreign wars are always very proud and happy to receive a distinguished guest. And we're always particularly proud and happy when that distinguished guest is a member of our organization. Your guest this morning fits in that category, for he was the first commander of Lieutenant Joseph Kennedy Jr. Post 5880 of Boston, Massachusetts, named after his brother who was killed in the war. Guest this morning was co-chairman of our 1946 convention in Boston, where many of us cut our eye teeth. He was elected to Congress in 1947 and to the Senate in 1952. And so, as your commander-in-chief, it's a great deal of pleasure for me to present Senator John F. Kennedy of Massachusetts.
Governor Williams, Commander, Vice Commander Connell, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I am proud to be here today. I'm proud to be here as a past commander of a Veterans of Foreign Wars post named after my late brother. But I was particularly proud to be a member of the Veterans of Foreign Wars when I arrived in this city last night, when I learned that this convention, after a series of rosy reassurances, had called for an increase in our defense strength. That resolution showed resolution, and it showed courage, and it makes me proud to be a member. I would like to give those rosy reassurances, too, as any American speaker would like to give them. I would like to tell you facts that the American people would like to hear. I would like to be able to say to you that categorically and proudly, I would like to be able to say that the United States is first in the world militarily, scientifically, economically, educationally, and will be in the future. But I cannot make that speech. I cannot, in all honesty, make those claims. I cannot go to the country with an appeal to the voters' complacency. That is not the function of any American. My appeal is to their duty. And it is refreshing to know that by your resolution, you responded to the appeal as you have in years past, the appeal of our country. Your convention resolution requires that every American ask himself these questions. Do we know for a fact that we are and will continue to be first in the world militarily, economically, scientifically, and educationally? Have you, since your days in school, ever known any boy or man of unsurpassed strength who did not always receive the respect of his enemies as well as his friends? And then ask yourselves whether you have ever known a period in the history of this country where this nation was treated with less respect and with more arrogance by our enemies around the world. And regarded with such doubt by our friends, I received this summer a letter from a woman who has spent her life in Africa. She said, for the first time in that continent, the people friendly to freedom were growing more doubtful and the communists growing more confident. Possibly the days preceding the War of 1812 were a precedent when the French and the British halted our ships and seized our people, much as the Russians seized the crew of the American RB-47 down in East Germany. But I can think of no other period in our history where peace conferences were broken off with such contempt, where our president was not free to travel abroad, where enemy rockets rattle off the coast of the United States 90 miles away, and when the leader of our leading enemy dared to voice an interference in our presidential elections. These are unpleasant facts, unpleasant to recite, unpleasant to face. But face them we must. For as Winston Churchill told the House of Commons, in a period of similar peril for Great Britain, we shall not escape our dangers by recoiling from them. To face those facts is not disloyalty, as some have implied. It is the highest type of loyalty. To state these facts does not divide the country. And let us hope Mr. Khrushchev knows it. As Secretary of State Herder, as Secretary of State Herder told him some weeks ago, Mr. Khrushchev, do not be deceived. We are a united country. We are not divided in our views on communism We are not divided, all of us, on our views on communism versus freedom, on firmness versus appeasement, on peace versus war. These are not an issue in this campaign. The issue in this campaign, and one which we all must face, regardless of our party, is which party can best summon all of our people of this country to rebuild and regain the strength of the free world. That is the only purpose of this debate. As veterans, we don't ask this nation to constantly look back on our service, on our deeds of sacrifice. But we do expect that a nation will try to make of itself such a standing in the world that the sacrifice of those who died in the last wars will be worthy of our present effort. We are still the strongest power in the world today, but communist power has been and is growing faster than our own at a greater rate of growth. And by communist power, I mean military power and economic power and scientific and educational power and political power. They are moving faster than we are. The world's first satellite was called a Sputnik, not Vanguard or Explorer. The first vehicle to the moon was named Lunik. The first living creatures to orbit the Earth were named Strelka and Belka, not Rover and Fido. Now let me make it clear that I believe there can be only one defense policy for the United States, and that is summed up in the word first. I do not mean first, but. I do not mean first, when. I do not mean first, if. I mean first, period. I mean first in military power across the board. Only then can we stop the next war before it starts. Only then can we prevent war by preparing for it. Let us always remember that Mr. Khrushchev is not going to be impressed with words. He is not going to be deterred by rhetoric. He is not going to be moved by argument or debate. We cannot, at the age of 65, make Mr. Khrushchev into a Democrat or a Republican by debate. Mr. Khrushchev respects only one thing, and that is power. Today, the United States is the greatest nation on earth. And today, we all agree that we are the most powerful nation on earth. But what of 5 or 10 years from now? This nation in 1965 will still be the greatest nation, but will it be the most powerful? The facts of the matter are that we are falling behind in our rate of growth. The missile lag looms larger. Our Army and Marine Corps lacks manpower and airlift. We need to put SAC on an airlift around the clock, and it is not in airlift today, as I visited the SAC headquarters last Saturday afternoon. We need to increase the thrust of our rocket engines. The Soviet Union's recent missile that they recovered weighed 5 tons. And until we get a powerful rocket engine, second to none, we are going to be second in space with all of the significance which space is going to have. We do not want the Soviet Union to be the first country to put a reconnaissance rocket around the globe, which will be like having a flight of U-2s pass over our country every day. All this can be done. All this can be done in this country. But let us put an end to this policy of deciding our fiscal requirements and then deciding what we can spend on defense. Let our danger decide our fiscal requirements, and then fit our fiscal requirements to meet them. As you know, there is a dispute over whether the administration should unfreeze defense funds previously appropriated by this Congress. Let me make my position crystal clear. I not only feel that these funds should be unfrozen, I strongly urge the next president of the United States, whoever he may be, to whichever party he may belong, to send to Congress in January specific requests. One, for accelerating the Polaris and Minuteman and other missile programs. Two, expanding and modernizing our conventional forces. Three, protecting our retaliatory capacity by an airborne alert. Four, streamlining our defense establishments to give primary attention to primary need. That message must be sent next January, whoever is president of the United States. This convention is no different, in my opinion, though its experience may have been different than any other group of Americans. There isn't anyone in this country who would not do anything to preserve this country's freedom. We are willing to bear the burden. Thomas Paine once said during the American Revolution, "The cause of America is the cause of all mankind." I think in a very real sense, the cause of all mankind is the cause of America. I do not want it to be said of us that in our years of responsibility, when the veterans of the Second World War had been out of the service for 15 years and of the First World War for 45 years or 43 years and of the Korean War for 7 years, with all of the 20 million Americans who once bore arms in defense of their country, I do not want it said in our time that in our generation, our country began to slip behind. I don't want historians to write in 1970 or 75 that it was in these years that communist power began to spread, that the communist balance of power began to shift in their direction. I want it said that these were the years when freedom stood up and when the United States, as the head of the free nations, bore its burdens, bore its responsibilities, and ensured the survival of freedom. Have we ever had a greater chance? There is not a single man here or a woman who is not prepared to do in peacetime what he did in war, assume the burdens of the defense of his country. This is the most dangerous time in the life of our country. All of us, as members of a free society, have a role to play. I don't run for the presidency, and I'm sure no other candidate does, merely saying that if he is elected, life will be easier. I don't believe it at all. I think the next 10 years are going to be the most critical years since our republic was founded. But therefore, that being true, should we not be willing to devote all of our energies in order to protect our security? I congratulate the veterans of foreign wars. Because in your resolution, you faced up in the way that you could to the problem that your country faced. During the Korean War, a young American was called out of the ranks by his Chinese captors. And they said to him, "What do you think of General George C. Marshall?" He said, "I think General Marshall is a great American." He was hit by the butt of a rifle and sent to the ground. And they picked him up and said, "What do you think of General George C. Marshall now?" He said, "I think General Marshall is a great American." This time there was no rifle butt, because in their own way, they had classified him and determined upon his courage. I think as individuals, and as members of the greatest country on earth. We too are going to be called out of the ranks, and we too in the 1960s must give the same affirmative answer.